Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have Polish Grey Cardinal Jarosław Kaczyński warning about how his country could be infected by the EU's social diseases. The influential politician was speaking at his party's convention over the weekend when he reaffirmed Poland's commitment to remaining in the EU, though with the important caveat that this, quote, doesn't mean we should repeat the mistakes of the West and become infected with social diseases that dominate there, end quote. He didn't specify exactly what he meant by this, but it can safely be assumed that one of the chief socio-religious ideologues of the Euro-realism movement was referring to the bloc's policy of so-called open borders and attendant lack of interest in assimilating and integrating civilizationally dissimilar new arrivals, the normalization of non-traditional sexual relations such as homosexuality and other practices, and possibly also the liberalization of abortion laws. Poland has recently come under criticism for gradually turning into what the ruling party's opponents describe as a clerical state because of the predominant influence that Catholicism wields over the government. While it might be uncommon for a contemporary European state to rely on religious values when formulating policy, it's actually nothing out of the ordinary elsewhere in the world. For example, many majority Muslim countries base their laws off of Islam, including secular ones such as Syria, as can be evidenced by Chapter 1, Article 3 of its 2012 Constitution, where it's clearly written that Islamic jurisprudence shall be a major source of legislation. All of this correlates to the rising role of civilizationalism in international relations ever since the end of the old Cold War. The ruling authorities in Poland feel it incumbent upon themselves to make their country the vanguard of Christian values in Europe following the forced secularization that took place in Central and Eastern Europe during the communist period, and which continued into the present day after the secular states of Western Europe imposed their values onto the region during the EU's rapid expansion there. The traditionally minded majority of the Polish population feel like they're losing their unique culture, which is inextricably tied to Catholicism, by the EU's aggressive secularization and what they popularly consider to be the clandestine Islamization of the continent by Muslim migrants. Hence, Kaczyński's channeling of their sentiment in warning about the bloc's so-called social diseases. The next one up is the scandalous report alleging that U.S. intelligence agents unsuccessfully tried to flip the famous Russian businessman Oleg Deripaska. The New York Times broke what would be a major story over the weekend, even if it's only partially true, and it's that the FBI supposedly had a decade-long relationship of an unclear nature with Mr. Deripaska that eventually fizzled out after he refused to go along with the deep state's Russiagate witch hunt fake news narrative about Trump, which eventually resulted in him being sanctioned by the American authorities. The full accuracy of the report can't be ascertained at this time, and it should be assumed that some parts of it might be exaggerated or outright fabricated as part of a new infowar offensive against Russia, but that's actually why it deserves to be analyzed. All facts and domestic political nuances aside, the very act of publishing this story suggests that the New York Times and their deep state partners partially intend to send a signal to President Putin that the U.S.'s secret services are trying to penetrate his trusted circle of confidants, which includes Mr. Deripaska and other big business representatives in Russia that are commonly described in the Western press as so-called oligarchs, an unclear number of whom were also supposedly contacted by the FBI as well. Building off of this, the U.S. might be trying to sow the seeds of paranoia within the inner ranks of Russia's political and economic elite, hoping that this will cause the government to counterproductively overreact and generate fault lines within the establishment that could then be exploited from abroad. To be clear, such a scheme won't succeed because it's based off of a fundamental misreading of the Russian establishment that's irredeemably clouded by wishful thinking and false expectations. But it does have one thing going for it, and it's the national security vulnerabilities inherent in big business representatives having homes and economic interests in countries that are waging hybrid warfare against their homeland. That's not at all to question the patriotism of these individuals, but just to point out that foreign forces will always try to take advantage of the state of affairs to provoke discord between these individuals and their governments, meaning that the devious infowar attack over the weekend won't by any means be the last. Third in our countdown, we have Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov lauding his country's relationship with Eritrea and informing the world about Moscow's plans to build a logistics center there. He was speaking alongside his Eritrean counterpart at a press conference in Sochi after their bilateral meeting, which he also noted included discussions about building regional transport corridors, pipelines, and opening up a Russian language department in one of Asmara's universities. Lavrov also said that the UNSC sanctions against Eritrea that were imposed in 2009 after reports that the country was aiding Somalia's al-Shabaab should be lifted, and he praised Eritrea for all that has done in the name of regional peace over the past few months in view of its rapidly moving rapprochement with Ethiopia that completely transformed the geopolitical situation in the Horn of Africa. In terms of the bigger picture, it appears as though Russia is keen to use Eritrea as a gateway to regional giant Ethiopia, which is the second most populous country in Africa and its fastest growing economy. The Eritrean-Ethiopian rapprochement will see Addis Ababa diversify its access to the rest of the world from its erstwhile mono-dependence on Djibouti, which will expectedly see Eritrea's connectivity role growing in importance as well. Moreover, Russia's intended investments in Eritrea signal that it's serious about its so-called pivot to Africa and eager to establish a strategic presence in the Red Sea Horn of Africa region after being reportedly offered a naval base in neighboring Sudan and amidst unconfirmed reports that it was earlier considering one in the breakaway region of Somaliland. Another point to bear in mind is that the UAE is Eritrea's top international partner and is responsible for not only breaking the country's international isolation after building a base there for assisting in the war on Yemen, but is also considered to be one of the key facilitators of the Eritrean-Ethiopian rapprochement. Abu Dhabi is therefore a rising trans-regional power that's also simultaneously cultivating much stronger ties with Moscow than ever before. With both parties signing an official declaration of strategic partnership in early June, after Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed traveled to the Russian capital to meet with President Putin. Accordingly, Russian-Emirati ties will converge in Eritrea and, possibly soon thereafter, even in Ethiopia as well. Unbeknownst to many, the Russian-Emirati strategic partnership is already surprisingly robust as it is even without any overlapping interests in the Horn of Africa. The two sides inked a nearly $2 billion defense deal in February 2017 and have vowed to cooperate in the cybersecurity and energy spheres. In addition, the oil-rich collection of Emirates wants to purchase Russia's electric cars and motorcycles, as well as the Arus brand of luxury sedans that President Putin recently popularized. In fact, the sky's not even the limit to Russian-Emirati cooperation. Literally, because Moscow is preparing to send one of its partner's cosmonauts to the International Space Station in the near future. Altogether, the grand strategic importance of Russian-Eritrean relations rests in their potential to not only facilitate Moscow's pivot to Africa and the Horn of Africa, and especially in Ethiopia, but also in their ability to strengthen the already solid and fast-moving partnership between Russia and the UAE via the third-party country in which they evidently have many shared interests. Furthermore, successfully proving the concept that Russian-Emirati cooperation can bring tangibly positive dividends in other countries such as Eritrea might also open up the door for Abu Dhabi to invite Moscow into South Yemen, where it previously exerted influence during the Soviet era, thereby possibly allowing it to contribute to the reconstruction of that war-torn society and solidify its strategic presence in the Red Sea Gulf of Aden region. Our runner-up is the U.S. suspending $300 million in aid to Pakistan. Technically speaking, the U.S. didn't cut off actual military aid in the physical sense that it's widely perceived to have done, but blocked money that was part of reimbursement for the loss of lives and financial losses that Pakistan suffered while leading the fight against terrorism, according to a clarification by Pakistan's new foreign minister. In any case, This hostile move is being done in order to advance several interconnected American objectives, the most public being to scapegoat Pakistan for the U.S.'s failures in Afghanistan, while the highest-level strategic one is to continue the U.S.'s policy recalibration towards India as its preferred partner in South Asia. The supposed pretext of Pakistan not doing enough to crack down on terrorist groups is disingenuous because the country doesn't harbor such forces and has actually been victimized by them over the decades, to the tune of over 60,000 martyrs. Nevertheless, the U.S. attempts to weave a semi-believable narrative in this regard by pointing to the active cross-border Pashtun community on both sides of the Durand Line, implying that Taliban members simply cross over into Pakistan from Afghanistan in order to seek reprieve from American airstrikes. That's not necessarily the case either, and the situation is more complex than such a simplistic storyline would suggest. No armed militants enter Pakistan through official border crossings, which are among the most secure in the world. Though Islamabad can't realistically screen each and every unarmed person arriving from Afghanistan for Taliban sympathies. As for those that might try to sneak into the country illegally, they found that to be pretty difficult in recent years, and it'll eventually become impossible once the border fence with Afghanistan is completed. Therefore, the whole case that the U.S. is trying to make about Pakistan supposedly harboring terrorist groups and actively aiding them is false from the get-go and designed to damage the country's international reputation. It's not just for the sake of trying to harm Pakistan's standing in the world and virtue signaling to its new Indian strategic partner that Washington is nastily disengaging from its erstwhile close relationship with Islamabad, but also because it may be preparing the narrative ground for sanctioning its former South Asian ally on supposed terrorist grounds that really have everything to do with obstructing CPEC. The U.S. is building the perception that Pakistan is a terrorist-infested country in order to legitimize what might be a forthcoming comprehensive sanctions campaign against it, similar to the one that is currently waging against Iran and which it recently began against Turkey. Expanding the U.S.'s existing economic warfare battlefield in the region to Pakistan would encompass the South Eurasian rimland portion of the so-called Greater Middle East that forms the southern half of the Golden Ring of Multipolar Gray Powers, which should put severe pressure on this very promising 21st century geopolitical construction, particularly as it relates to the possibility of imposing secondary sanctions against companies that use this Pakistani transiting CPEC. The whole point is to decrease the economic appeal of this game-changing Silk Road corridor as part of the U.S.'s containment strategy against Pakistan and China, though it might unintentionally catalyze the same trans-regional integrational processes that it's trying to sabotage. At our top spot, we've got the terrorist assassination of the president of the Donetsk People's Republic and the impact it'll have on the Ukrainian civil war. As is now known from the wisdom of hindsight, Alexander Zakharchenko's assassination wasn't the trigger for reigniting conventional hostilities between Kiev and the Donbas republics like some people feared it would be immediately after the event happened, though that of course doesn't mean that it wasn't the intention of those who carried out the act and patronized the terrorists. It's because of the cool-headedness and self-restraint of the Donetsk authorities that they opted not to act against Kiev, which most observers suspect to have masterminded this operation together with Washington. That's not to say that some response or another won't be forthcoming, but just that it'll probably stick to the realm of shadow wars for now. Another point to keep in mind is that the assassination was designed to cultivate an atmosphere of fear and suspicion within the rebel ranks, as well as decrease the population's faith in the authorities. Donetsk was unexpectedly forced to experience a sudden leadership transition under the most trying of circumstances, and the new authorities will need to stabilize the situation on the home front before seriously considering any conventional response, such as the recommencement of large-scale conflict with Kiev. The reason why the central government didn't take military advantage of the situation is because the rebels' armed forces remained vigilant despite the political crisis inside their self-proclaimed republic, which wasn't what Kiev expected. The timing of Zakharchenko's assassination also deserves to be looked at because it appears as though it was meant to coincide with the upcoming opening ceremony of the UN General Assembly later this month, during which Poroshenko could use his global pulpit to try and rally the Western world against Russia and the rebels. That's another reason why any conventional response to this assassination would come under increased scrutiny, because it would be framed as so-called aggression and exploited as the tripwire for more sanctions, which might be promulgated anyhow under other infowar pretexts, but which Russia would prefer to have nothing to do with the Ukrainian civil war so long as it's continuing its incipient rapprochement with Minsk partners France and Germany. In fact, it might even be the case that Russia is utilizing its channels of communication with the Donbas rebels to encourage them to refrain from any reckless military action in response to the latest terrorist provocation, understanding that a conventional response under the present, keyword, circumstances might actually play into the US and Kiev's hands. Again, that shouldn't be taken to mean that this possible assessment of the situation is set in stone, but just that this is probably how Russia perceives it at the given moment in view of the prevailing international situation, and that the most likely outcome in the near term is a continuation of the shadow wars between Kiev and the Donbas republics, but no large-scale conflict. Alright folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice weekend, and tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.